Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our guest this hour is Dana Priest. She is co-author of Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. She is also co-author of the remarkable Washington Post investigative series on intelligence gathering. She's an investigative reporter for the Washington Post, has received 2 Pulitzer Prizes for her work. She is the author of other books, and this book is a knockout. I read a lot of books, as you know, for my job, but last night we were watching the Brewers because the pennant race is looming, but I was so absorbed in this book, and I was every, it seemed like 10 minutes, saying to those gathered in the living room, you got to hear this, you got to hear this. It's just an amazing work, and I don't think that Americans know very much about this, so there are lots of questions about why we don't know much about this and the amount of money that we're spending in economically depressed times in this country is quite something, to say nothing of the fact that you've got so many secret operations that nobody even knows what the secrets are anymore or who knows who the secrets are. This is about counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence gathering activities having become so large, so secretive that no one knows how much money it costs, how many people it employs, how many programs exist within it, or exactly how many agencies do the same work. The other remarkable thing about this is she starts the book talking about the amount of money that Congress was just giving to counterterrorism, perhaps understandably, while the Pentagon was still smoldering, and ends the book with the amount of money and the size of the apparatus, even though the current president wanted to have things be much more transparent. But indeed, that has not happened. Do we need this now when the threat is not as great as it was? It's a remarkable book. And Dana, thank you so much for being with us. It is one of those books that I read and I kept saying, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Did you ever
thank you, Kathleen.
You must have said that. You say that all the time, I'm sure. Oh my gosh.
I do. I mean, 20 years of covering national security, you'd think that, you know, nothing would surprise you. But as I started doing this with my colleague, Bill Arkin, that happened repeatedly. It just, the numbers were so big, they were not easy to get. So every time a new number, you know, every time we could get one, but also when we visited places, you know, I'd just leave saying, I cannot believe this.
Right.
So it happened all the time. It kept me going in a way.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've done it because we just don't know about this and we need to. It's almost understandable. You start the book with the Pentagon still smoldering and the money being given to counterterrorism because we were downright frightened and rightfully so. So let's just throw a lot of money. Let's create all these organizations. We got to fight this by all means necessary.
Well, exactly. And what we had wasn't working. In fact, it failed miserably to detect this plot by 19 young people with box cutters. So nobody had confidence in the intelligence world. What Congress did is pretty understandable with the president. They basically cut a number of blank checks. In fact, Congress offered far more to the Defense Department and the intelligence agencies and the FBI than even did the White House. And it just kept coming. But at the same time, they said, but nobody wants government to grow because that's not politically palatable. So go hire contractors. So that was one of the major pushes in the very beginning, was grow everything bigger. Anyone that calls their agency counterterrorism related now can get funding. And of course, everybody did. And they began the hiring of contractors that were supposed to be cheaper than federal employees because you wouldn't have to give them benefits. You could fire them when you wanted to. But it has ended up really costing 2 to 3 times as much money as the federal workforce and has created a dependency on profit-making corporations who, this is not a criticism of profits, but that's what they're in business for. And they are never going to say, no, thank you, we don't need that contract. They are always going to lobby effectively, it seems, for more. So this created an impetus just to keep the money flowing.
You have a picture. I don't think many people who go into Washington, D.C. even know about this. The National Business Park Complex of private corporations blocks away from the National Security Agency. This is huge, this complex.
Oh, it's so big. This is one of the moments where I said, I can't believe this. And that took us a while to find. I, you know, didn't know it existed, didn't know I was looking for it even. But what happened was we had discovered in a very sideways way that there was a concentration around the National Security Agency, which is the nation's eavesdropper, does a lot of spying electronically overseas mostly, but also in the United States. And it grew by more than twice, you know, its pre-9/11 size. And because it's so technical, it really became dependent on contractors, so much so that they gathered around the NSA. And this is just one example of a business park that stretches for maybe 100 acres at least and is filled with all the names of the top contractors. And they aren't trying to hide. They are boastful about what they – I take it their buildings are boastful about what they do. They're these beautiful glass steel buildings with sort of their corporate logos flying proudly. And they're right across from the NSA, and they have actually a bridge that connects the two that only they can use. It just, to me, seemed to be a symbol of how dependent both sides had become on the relationship and how large the contracting base had become. And in fact, we call this the capital of top secret America, which is what we did was we located, trying to find these agencies and companies who work at the top secret level. We couldn't even do it at the secret level. There were so many. We wanted to locate them on a map, and we developed what we call an alternative geography of the United States, which in the capital is near the National Security Agency, where the densest cluster of both sub-agencies that work with the NSA and corporations are located.
And doesn't it just, when you said that, and I'm reminded of these 19 young people with box cutters, which just sort of blew us away when all of that happened. All of this money, all of these agencies, and they're looking for more box cutters.
Well, a lot of them are. A lot of them are looking for the same thing that everyone else is looking for. That's, you know, there is no question that we are safer than we were before 9/11. It's no doubt that we are safer because of some organizations that are very focused. You know the names of most of them: the FBI's counterterrorism agents, the CIA's analysts, the NSA's Al Qaeda analysts. This group I write about, which amounts to a secret army, which is the killing teams that killed Bin Laden. You know, those very focused agencies have literally almost wiped Al-Qaeda off the face of the earth. And yes, new groups have come along, but they're very focused on them too. But what also emerged, which I think makes up the bulk of what we call Top Secret America, are organizations whose mission's not clear, whose mission is vague, who aren't focused on a unique mission, and who end up doing a mediocre job that really perhaps doesn't need to be done. And I'm speaking in a sense for people inside the organizations, because of course I don't have a security clearance and I can't see into these programs. I can only develop this idea from the so many sources who talk to us, many of them senior, many of them have been around and devoted their lives to the post 9/11 era and trying to make us safer.
I can't even imagine, Dana, how difficult it must have been to put this together. I just can't imagine. First of all, to find these secret places, because they're secret places, and to talk to people, and it is so massive and so hard for you to gather information. What a feat.
Well, thank you. It was surprisingly, this is all put together by publicly available information. It's not easy to find. You can't Google it. But there were methodologies that we explain in the book that allowed us to do this, and that I think, frankly, surprised the government. We showed a lot of our statistics and details to the government, and I often do that when I have very sensitive information that we want to put in the Washington Post. And they, I think, were very surprised at what we found.
Yeah. One of the segments I was reading aloud last night, because it was just overwhelming, was all the security that was in place for the Obama inauguration. It is just, there was an alternate universe at place that nobody knew about. Would you describe it to us? And does it indicate that we've gone a little bit overboard?
Well, you know, I really wanted that scene to portray the good sense of this world, that everybody could come together and protect the new president who needed protection for all the reasons that we know. First African-American, you know, crazy group still out there. But you're right, the amount of it was stunning, and I'm sure that we just had the tip of the iceberg. You know, we had something like 200,000 police and military troops around. Oh, sorry, not 200, but 45,000 together of these troops and civil defenders. There were there were people stationed all along the eastern seaboard, snipers, sharpshooters, automatic license plate readers that were keeping tabs on all the cars coming out of as far away as West Virginia and as far up north as is probably north of New York City. There were air sniffers that were looking for chemicals and biological agents in the air that, you know, continually monitored the airflow around the nation's capital. There were sensors embedded in the pavement in case a truck came by that was really much heavier than it looked like it should have been, indicating perhaps a car bomb. There were you know, just you name it, FBI agents in the crowds, CIA pulsing all of its databases looking for signals that something might be happening, NSA doing the same thing. There were layers upon layers of aircraft, surveillance aircraft, and really the most impressive, because you could see a little bit of it in the aftermath, was all the video of the crowds and so many different angles. Again, the license plate readers, the egresses and exits into the city could all be brought together under the Secret Service's command center, which really was running the operation, and could fuse this together, look for anomalies, send people out if they found them, turn on sensors if they were interested in a certain location. And then, of course, Obama stood behind 5 tons of bulletproof glass. And had a new vehicle that was, you know, like a vault that he rode around in.
Oh, my. And simultaneously, there was a report coming, which you must tell us about, from Somalia that almost canceled the inauguration. There was talk about doing that.
I don't think it almost did, but I do think it was raised as a possibility because there was a threat from Al-Shabaab, which is an organization based in Yemen and believed to be quite strong, stronger than they had initially thought two or three years ago. So turned out, so that scattered the FBI agents all over the country and the world to go and re-interview people that might know anything about this. There was, at the highest levels, a mention of canceling. I don't think anybody seriously considered it, but it was a mention. I think it also served as a learning point for the Obama administration's incoming national security team about how serious everybody took threats like this. It turned out to be what the FBI calls a poison pen, which is somebody ratting out someone else for an alternative reason, in this case, a family feud. So,
oh my gosh.
But they didn't really find that out until after the inauguration. So that's why you had a heightened alert everywhere.
If you have these massive numbers of people and agencies all over the country looking for threats, how many believed threats are there that turn out to be not to believe threats that cause all of this chaos and worry and concern and alert levels? And it's nothing just because we have the security where everything can become a believed threat almost.
Right. Well, my favorite saying that a four-star general once told me was, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
And so
right.
You have this giant security apparatus, and the way it views the world is through, you know, everything is a threat somehow. And not to minimize the idea that there are bad people out there, but especially in the first few years, there was so much information that was all just bad about threats. But that kept the alerts going up. It kept people on their toes. I think it kept the public initially very worried and then confused, where I do believe people remain today. It's kept us, what I say in the book, is at a perpetual state of yellow, which is
yes.
significant risk with no specific information. So what is that? How are you supposed to interpret that? And some people and I write about this one 70-something-year-old woman who's in a wheelchair and has to get herself out of the wheelchair to go through security at the airport. And I went and interviewed her thinking that she would say, oh, this is crazy. But she said, no, I could be a terrorist. I could have a bomb.
Right.
Well, no terrorist has ever fit her profile. And actually, no terrorist has ever been caught that I know of going through a security scanner like that. But it's a indicator of how we've all accepted, or a lot of us have accepted, that as a normal state of affairs, which leads to the most, I think, significant point about the book and about all this, which is, if we want to figure out how to get it right, you know, I don't think the big size makes it any more able to actually catch terrorists. In fact, I think the big size makes it more confusing right now and may well defeat efforts to do that. But if you want to do the best with all this money, then you have to start by having an honest conversation with the public about the threat. And that hasn't happened yet. And I know that because I talk all the time with insiders about the threat, and nobody really has told us much about the fact that Al-Qaeda is in such a sorry state, which is, by the way, a success.
Right.
And, you know, it's all still classified. And so that's why we don't one of the reasons why that doesn't happen.
Well, and as you say, early on, in the 10 years, it's been 10 years, they've made vast strides in technical surveillance capabilities and intelligence. They have killed, you write, so many Al-Qaeda operatives that only hundreds are left in the world, so the dragnet approach no longer makes much sense, to say nothing of the fact that we are in really tough economic times, unless we want everybody to work to get top security clearance and everybody work for this system, right?
Which is really sort of a reality. I mean, the government this week came out with figures. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is supposed to manage the intelligence community, came out with figures on the number of people with security clearances, and it blew us away.
Really?
We thought we had we wanted to be conservative, but we still thought we had a lot, which was 850,000 with top secret. Well, it's much higher than that. And in fact, the number of contractors with clearances is twice as high as we thought. There's a 500,000 people in the country with security clearances who work for profit-making companies, and millions, literally 2.8 million, almost 3 million federal employees who have clearances. So it's quite a big workforce.
Oh, my. And yet, I mean, it's really a real enigma here, because you also say, or somebody said this, who wants to be the guy who says we don't need this anymore, and then 3 weeks later
right.
something happens?
Right. And I think that is the political reality, that because there's not an honest discussion, that means that the public can get away with taking responsibility for determining how much really should be spent on this risk by, you know, always criticizing the government if someone were to slip by. It's unlikely, just like it's unlikely that there are going to be no more car accidents, even though we all wear our seatbelts, and it's unlikely that there is not going to ever be another Oklahoma City, you know, because there are crazy people in the world. So is it really realistic to expect that all this is going to stop every single idea, you know, everything, single thing you could call terrorism? No. But yet, you know, because we don't talk about it in a realistic way, that's what's going to be the reaction from the public and politically. And the answer to that reaction is always, we need more.
Yeah.
And that means more spending and more contractors in an era in which there is less for everybody else.
And why is it, we talked about the beginning of the book, the end of the book, you talk about the president who's not altered the size or even begun to attack the inefficiency of top secret America, even though he campaigned and talked early in his administration about being open and closing Guantanamo. Why have things gone along just the way they used to go along?
Well, I think that's a question we only partly answer. In part, I think it's because Obama adopted a lot of the practices that Bush had put in place. We see that with the drones, the lethal drone strikes, the targeted killings of the JSOCs, the secret army that I write about, and their effort to kill Al-Qaeda leaders and Taliban leaders, and the same with the CIA. Picking off individuals or the small networks that they are connected to, and also the use of drones that have these missiles on them. He didn't, quote, close Guantanamo, found that to be, I guess, too politically risky from, you know, what we hear him say on that subject. The issue of why he's not more forthcoming is a little bit of a surprise. I would think that it's because the advisors just don't want to do that. It has always been easier to classify something than to declassify it, and that's always been the trend, even though, as we see, we write in the last chapter, the conclusion, there's this parallel universe of, I would call it, involuntary disclosures, the WikiLeaks, the press that's so active around these issues. So it's too hard for the government to try to keep all the secrets that it's classifying. And even people in that business say, you know, we need to start over. We need to really ask ourselves what really needs to be secret and try to safeguard those, because they're not doing a very good job of keeping everything else secret.
Dana Priest, our guest this hour. We're going to go to phone calls momentarily. Her book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. She's an investigative reporter and a fine one at that for The Washington Post. She has received two Pulitzer Prizes for her work. She's the author of The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open as we go to you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Because she's been covering these kinds of stories for such a long time, she also, if you want to go back to why we believed curveball and how we got in the war in Iraq, and the lack of intelligence that we had or believing the wrong people in those years. It's also a part of course, this narrative. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dana Priest, and let's start with Laura in New Berlin. Hi, Laura. Hello, Laura.
Thank you, Kathleen and Dana, for this critical discussion. Dana, I heard you September 6th on Fresh Air with Terry Gross say that 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in America are linked to this top secret apparatus. I wonder if you might identify those 7 counties and say more about how that wealth flows from a state of secrecy. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, that's one of my favorite factoids that we unearthed during this, and it comes from Census Bureau data. After we found the clusters and the density, which really beyond the Baltimore area where the NSA is located is around the Washington area, well, we just stumbled upon the Census Bureau data, which named the 10 wealthiest counties in the country. And they overlapped. So if you really want me to name them, I can. I hope I can. It's Loudoun, Howard, Fairfax County, Fairfax City, Alexandria, Arlington, and Montgomery County.
Hmm.
All of those have or are right on the border of major intelligence agencies. And they are hubs within our clusters within the top secret universe. And it's not to say that there aren't other factors, but I think that, what it does show is the ripple, the trickle-down effect, if you will, of all this money going to mainly to the contractors, because the federal workforce is, yes, also concentrated in that area, but federal employees aren't paid as so much money that that by itself would boost these counties into that bracket. It's really the lobbyists and the contractors and the companies themselves and the people that work for the companies that feed Top Secret America, where the wealth is concentrated.
You write about some of these job availabilities being on monster.com.
Right.
And it's kind of, I mean, it's alarming, but it's also kind of amusing in a way, the job descriptions of what people were, how much they were getting paid and where they were going.
Right. And this is one of our big finds that we discovered that, you know, that's top secret website, monster.com, was a place that you could put in the search engine top. You could put in top secret, and you can still today, and you can get a listing of all the jobs at monster.com that require a top secret clearance. And then if you look in the job descriptions, they sometimes give you a sense of what they do, either through the title or the description itself. And then some of them actually give code names for programs that they want the job applicant to have worked on before. Well, those code names also helped us broaden our universe, because we could cross-reference those with another secret website called LinkedIn, where people put a lot of information in their biographies, even people who work in the intelligence world. And so between those two, plus a lot of other digging using contracts and what have you, that's how we put together this universe.
Let's go to Richard next in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to compliment the author on her book. I think it is wonderful work.
Thank you.
I have is that we endure very serious paranoia in this country now. It has caused us to sacrifice all of our civil liberties, including habeas corpus. The reason for that, I think, is that we have been making war on third world peoples ever since 1950, and we seem to be incapable of reevaluating our foreign policy. The world finally catches on. If anybody is to be regarded as the man of the century or the man of the year, it is surely Osama bin Laden, because he has persuaded us to destroy ourselves.
Dana.
Well, I think that the effectiveness of terrorism is what you say. You know, Osama bin Laden could not defeat the United States. That's largely why terrorists turn to terrorism, because they don't have armies at their disposal to destroy their enemies. And it was not just the attack. It was the fallout from the attack. And in the book, you know, we really ask people to think about this, that we have turned so much of our government over to defeating what is a small network of individuals. And the paranoia that you speak about is a part of that. And while I don't agree that we've turned our civil liberties over, I do think there is a creeping encroachment on those civil liberties, which we talk about in the domestic chapters of the book, and how the Department of Homeland Security in particular has waged what I call this dragnet approach to finding terrorists by enlisting local police and sheriff's departments and citizens to report suspicious activity. You know, that has never worked as an approach. And it is something that can, you know, I think we need to question, is this appropriate? And has our whole response, the fact that we get hysterical every time, and I would include the media in that too,
every time
there is an incident.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, is that a mature way to deal with what is a small number of fanatical extremists?
Thanks, Richard, for the call. What is our policy now? Some of the news of today is that we've got more drones on the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. You write about what used to be not our policy of assassination of people. What is our policy concerning assassination, and how is this drone program growing?
The drone program is absolutely growing. Now, the government does not consider it assassination. Assassination was banned in the 1960s. It was, you know, the definition is somewhat vague, but it needs to have generally it has a more political component. In other words, assassination is when you kill off a political leader. So the government lawyers believe that this is not that. They call it targeted killings. Other people disagree because they are targeting individuals who lead an organization, I guess is what you'd say. The lawyers also say that because we were attacked, it's a defensive approach, that we are defending ourselves against people who are actively plotting to attack the United States again. And the Obama administration has adopted that interpretation of what they're doing. The articles today in the Washington Post talk about the expanded number of bases in the Arabian Peninsula. The operations that are expected to increase are in Yemen and Somalia. They may go elsewhere, Nigeria perhaps. It is a safe way to destroy individuals without risking American lives, which I think the American public is probably fed up with the two long-term wars that we've been engaged in. So it's tended to be a politically acceptable way to continue the pressure on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the affiliates of Al-Qaeda.
Who's making the analysis, or are there so many agencies and so many, this is such a huge thing that nobody can sit around the table and decide what the strategy should be at this point because of the change, dramatically weakened nature of the enemy?
Well, I do think it all is done at the White House. This strategy, the drone program, that is all concentrated. That is Obama and his chief national security advisors have decided on this policy. And it kind of flows down from there to the troops that actually carry it out, the drone operators or the JSOC. This is a special operations group that's very secretive. The people that conduct, they are the people that conduct actual raids on the ground to do the same thing as the drone strikes, to capture or kill, but not really capture these days because there's no place to put people who you capture. Nobody wants anybody else to be sent to Guantanamo because they are actually hoping that someday they can close it down. But the decisions, the legal interpretation is made by the White House lawyers in the Office of the Legal Counsel. But it's also made partnership, I guess you could say, with the CIA General Counsel and the DOD General Counsel, who also are involved because their units are involved. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I describe John Rizzo, who was the General Counsel of the CIA for many years, and he talks about the process of deciding who should go on the kill list, who should stay on the kill list, and a little bit about how that process was put together and works.
Hmm. Ken in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good morning. Say, just a quick comment. If this was an issue that was embraced by the conservative media, this would be an issue that would be drumbeat until the election. That being said, earlier this month there was a news story out of D.C. that between $30 and $60 billion were wasted on Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts in the sense of not being able to account for those sums of money, whether it's putting money towards Karzai and he's pocketing mm-hmm. it. I was wondering if Dana's topic and the expenses incurred on it have included that $30 to $60 billion that's unaccountable.
I don't think that they do. I think those are funds that were particularly, used in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we try to stay away from the tactical level issues or operations in those wars. So So you've reminded me of another thing that actually isn't even in the book. I wish I'd thought about it. But
there's another book, I'm sure.
Yeah. But not all of the budgets of the intelligence agencies can even be accounted for in the way that all other federal budgets are accounted for. And it's because that many of them have grown up not doing basic bookkeeping is the best way I can say it. The GAO and the Office of Management and Budget, which supervises budgets throughout the government, is working on that, but not all of them can get even an accounting of the money it spends, where it goes, and that sort of thing. So you know that there's waste in there.
Yeah. Thank you, Ken. Steve is next in Broadhead. Hi, Steve.
Hi. You answered most of the question I had, but I still wondered about what evidence you had to reach the conclusion that there was waste. Other than the fact that there's a lot of money being spent, what evidence did you have that there actually is inefficiency and waste and how much money is being spent?
Well, I'll give you some more examples, and again, they come from people on the inside, some of whom were officially interviewed by me, you know, with other minders around, and others were sources of mine that are well-placed but were not officially granted permission to talk with me. I'll give you one example, which is one of my favorite, in the area of intelligence analysis, which is a key area, because if you got all these dots, these infamous dots, unless you have a good analyst looking at them, they're not worth anything. And analysts can tell you what's going on. Well, the qualifications for analysts are not very high at some agencies. They got a lot of space. They got the billets, the actual body spaces, and they just hired on people, lots of them college graduates who went to work for contractors. Anyway, there is a lack of coordination among analysts, a lot of overlap. And one indicator of that is that every year these analysts write together 50,000 intelligence reports. And this is a figure that the Director of National Intelligence Office sources told me. And many of the other people said, this is crazy. You know, I was shown actually one database of just an ad nauseum number of reports, so many of them overlapping and without any unique information, that it caused the people that they were writing them for, the senior managers of various departments, to not, you know, not bother to look at them, not hope to read most of them, and to feel totally overwhelmed by this volume. And so the answer to it, which also tells you a little bit about how more is always the answer was to come up with yet another set of reports that picked the best reports from all these reports. And that was met by the rolling of the eyes by one person who really should have been in favor of it, given that it was his agency that put it together. So that's just one example of the redundancy and overlap. But you have to know that the system's gotten so large that even though sharing has gotten better, there's too many people to share with and so many operations that other areas of the government don't know about, that often they don't know who they should be, who they're leaving out in the meetings, because it's just gotten so big.
Tell us about, because this kind of went off our radar, and you bring it up in the book, Dana, the secret CIA prisons. Whatever happened to those? You talk about a compartment of Greystone. What is Greystone, and where are, right, do we still have those prisons?
We don't have those prisons. Greystone, first of all, and it's in the book because this is where a lot of these secret programs began. On September 17th, President Bush signed a presidential finding that allows for the covert action programs to be put in place. And the whole point of it was to go out and defeat Al-Qaeda and its supporters. It was pretty vague in that regard. And the agency ran with it, as you would expect them to. And they created, under the codename Greystone, the largest covert action program in its history. And many of its parts do continue today because it includes everything that is supposed to be covert, meaning the hand of the U.S. government is never supposed to be found. And it included the secret prisons and the infamous rendition flights where people would be literally disappeared off the streets of one country and flown for interrogations into another, often using the harsh interrogation techniques that have since been repudiated. The secret prisons were a part of that. And to set up these prisons just required so much infrastructure, not only people to negotiate with the countries involved to get equipment and personnel there secretly, but also to cover it all up with cover identities and cover organizations and on and on and on. So Bush closed the secret prisons, I believe it was 2006. And as far as we know, there are no more, they don't exist anymore because they were the CIA's, the CIA only ran them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are prisons in Afghanistan that I believe are run by the Afghans, but really are run by the U.S. And they say those don't amount to secret prisons because they're run usually by the military, and the military has more accountability rules that are overseen by people other than themselves.
What about in Somalia? So, Are there secret prisons in Somalia?
I don't think that there are, partly because Somalia is such a failed state that it would be difficult to maintain security around any U.S. facility there. So I don't think that they exist. And the Obama administration has said that they are closed, so I don't think they exist anymore.
And
that's one reason that people who were in the prisons were then brought to Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
And so now anybody else who would have qualified to be in a secret prison, in other words, the agency, the CIA, wanted to have total control over them and have them not be put into any judicial system, it doesn't exist anymore. So that means the CIA is interrogating people in foreign prisons, foreign-owned prisons. So those are, owned by other governments. Sometimes those governments, often those governments, are those with not a great track record with human rights. But with the Arab Spring, some of those prisons used to be in places like Egypt and Jordan and probably Algeria. With the Arab Spring, I don't know if those prisons have also been de facto closed.
Hmm. And yet you do say, and I'm wondering how many people you're talking about, that all of the disappeared from all of those secret prisons have been accounted for.
Well, I believe that there are several dozen people who remain disappeared, who the CIA captured, rendered somewhere, probably to their own facilities, who have never been accounted for. And so they remain disappeared from the face of the earth. And the CIA is not going to talk about them. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been trying to figure out who they are and where they might be, but they're not going to talk about them either. But sources do tell me that there are several dozen of them.
Hmm. Dana Priest, our guest. The book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dana Priest, our guest. The book is Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. I guess it's not surprising that at one point you were summoned to the CIA headquarters. And I believe it was after you had returned from Germany, wasn't it, Dana?
Well, I don't say where I came back from.
Oh, okay. But, wherever she came back from.
It was overseas, and I was at that point looking for the black sites, the secret prisons. And I found enough evidence to be able to know for sure and write in the paper, if we wanted to, that there were several of them in Eastern European countries. And the White House really did not want us to, well, they didn't want the story done at all, but they certainly didn't want us to name the countries where these prisons were located. And that caused a number of meetings that led, it started with the CIA, but led up to President Bush, who called, not me, but our editor who makes the decision, who was Len Downey at the time. And he went over to the White House with Donald Graham, the publisher and owner of the paper, and a couple other people. And they had a meeting with President Bush and his national security team, including Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, in which they tried to argue with them that if we even wrote the story about the secret prisons, it would put countries at risk and it would make countries not deal with the CIA anymore because they couldn't keep their secrets. This is usually what they are arguing when they don't want information out. But sometimes, you know, it goes beyond that, putting lives at risk even. This time that was not an argument. So as we don't have prior censorship in this country like they do in Israel and Britain, and so it really is left to the Washington Post editor to decide. And he decided sort of to split the difference, to say, well, we won't name the particular countries, but we will say Eastern Europe. And that's what we did. Huh. And the sky didn't fall after that. And there was a bump in relations with, I would say, a speed bump in relations with the countries involved. But as far as I could tell, those relations have gone back to normal. There's a lot of intelligence sharing still. And the argument that I make in the book is that, you know, come on, terrorism does affect more than just the United States. And so it is in the benefit, it's to all countries to work together to defeat it. And that is more important and steadfast, in a sense, than disagreements over a particular operations.
Hmm. We go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you. I don't know if you remember or not. I certainly do, about what happened right after 9/11. There was such a surprise that people were asking the question about why do they hate us, and bookstores were selling out of the Quran. But my question really had to do with the issue of Israel and Palestine, and whether or not things are being hiked up a little bit now as this question about Palestinian statehood comes up in the UN.
Hmm. Well, it's a little bit off the point
of
the book, so I'm going to punt on a lot of it, except to say, you know, all sides are very revved up about it, and the stakes are high for everybody, so...
Can you give us some idea? I'm just trying to figure out the amount of money that we've spent, if indeed we even know that, the number of people who are involved in agencies, and what we need to do, and if we're even capable of reining this in somehow. Do we need to rein it in?
Well, I think what needs to be done is at least an honest look at what is happening inside. And it can't be done by the agencies who have the most to benefit from keeping the status quo going. I don't see that happening. And I don't see it happening from the oversight committees where it should be happening either, which is in Congress. This world is different than any other part of government. Because it's all classified, that puts a particular onus on the intelligence committees, who are the ones that these agencies report to. And they're supposed to tell them how they spent the money that Congress gave them. Well, all the members of that committee say they are overburdened. This world's grown so much and their staffs have not. But again, I don't see the White House making any effort. Maybe because of the budget cuts that are coming, that will force some cuts, but will it be judicious? I mean, there are things inside of this world that work incredibly well, that have developed an expertise that has resulted in all of the deaths of so many al-Qaeda members. So you don't want to throw out what works. You want to just identify what works and get rid of what is not adding value. So, again, I don't really see a broad brush effort to do that. And maybe it would remain all classified and we wouldn't see it anyway, which is an irony.
And what in 30 seconds, what is working?
Well, I think domestically, the FBI's counterterrorism agents is where terrorists have been found. Mm-hmm. Overseas, the CIA analysts, the NSA's Al-Qaeda analysts, the special JSOC troops of the secret army, if the tactics is to kill people who are involved in this, they're the ones that have been doing it the most effectively and the most, the most effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are to name a few. And there are many other generally relatively small organizations who have a laser focus on what they should be doing. And those are the areas that really progress has been made.
Yeah. Dana, thank you so much for being with us. It is just such an important book. And I appreciate your time and
all of
the work behind this, all of the work. Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Dana Priest is the author. It's published by Little Brown. She's, of course, an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Some of the findings, and there's a lot more in the book, were in the Post in their special series about a year ago. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for production and on-air production, and thanks for listening.